most business observers would agree. The biggest story coming out of the tech and entertainment industries this past week was the unwinding of Quibi, a once highly anticipated consumer tech product launched last April by entertainment mogul Jeffrey Katzenberg and headed up by Meg Whitman, this week's featured guest of GameFace Execs. Before voluntarily shutting down Quibi on October 22nd, Meg, one of the most respected executives of the last 30 years, took a startup called eBay from $4 million to $8 billion in just 10 years. She led Hewlett-Packard as president and CEO, and she even mounted an impressive campaign for California governor on the Republican ticket in the 2010 election. I'm pleased to bring you now just the second interview Meg has given since she and Mr. Katzenberg announced the dissolution of Quibi. Everyone at the Association of Luxury Suite Directors, it's my pleasure and honor to introduce our first keynoter to kick off our 2020 conference, Meg Whitman. Meg, thanks for joining us. We appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, happy to be here.
We've had this on the docket for a long time to speak with you. Thanks to Jeff Birding and the other folks at FC Cincinnati, for whom you are a managing partner, a minority owner. And we're so grateful that you've joined the sports industry about a year ago, wasn't it? November of 19?
Yeah.
And so it's been something, as I say, we've been looking forward to. Let's get right into it. This is a crazy time for everybody. COVID, pandemic, the economy, the election season. There's so much going on. Certainly in your life, a lot has been going on for the last week. That's the worst kept secret. Tell us what the last week has been for you and for Quibi.
Yeah. Well, you might recall that Jeffrey Katzenberg and I founded Quibi about 2.5 years ago with this idea of premium short form content for your mobile device for in between moments on the go. And we launched in the middle of the pandemic. And, did all kinds of things to pivot the business, to try to make a go of it. And ultimately, we decided that the best thing to do, and we announced this last week, was to actually wind down Quibi and return cash to shareholders, which most folks don't do, but we're, mature business executives. We've been around the block, and we decided that was the best thing to do. So we were heartbroken. It was so disappointing. We had such high hopes for the business, but startups are risky, and we launched, as you point out, in a difficult time. So that's what we announced last week.
Yeah, startups are risky, and most startups don't make it. And in the technology world, it's probably even more kind of a precarious situation. A lot of us in the sports and entertainment world, sometimes we feel like startups. And right now in this environment, it kind of feels like everyone's a kind of a startup because we're having to reinvent so much. What are some things either from the recent past, even the last week, and also over the course of your career, what are some things that you could perhaps share with us, best practices or lessons learned about how you launch a product? And then also perhaps you could share with us how you gracefully exit a product.
Yeah. Well, listen, I think, all startups rely on entrepreneurs. And I would say one of the things I love about the sports industry is it is a group of entrepreneurs, people who are doing things that haven't been done before. They're constantly reinventing. And entrepreneurs are a special breed. They really are, because they see things that, most people don't see. And they're willing to take bets that most people might not be willing to take. And so, whenever you're thinking about starting something new, I always look at what are the trends, makes you believe that you can be successful? What is the open space in the market? And what is going to be your point of difference? And then who do you think about as your competition? And I think probably everyone on this, in this meeting has had to go through that. I think we live in a very unique time. I mean, things are changing incredibly rapidly. It's very uncertain. And so I think the lesson learned for right now is, how do you stay flexible? How do you think through what you thought was a good idea maybe 2 weeks ago might not seem like such a great idea anymore. So flexibility, adapting to the set of circumstances. And I also think as regards COVID, I think we're in this for the long haul. And what you can see is COVID has sort of gone in waves. And, I think until there's a vaccine, we're going to be in this situation. And so I would just say, hold your resources tight. This is going to be a longer fight, I think, than any of us thought. And so any way you can be thoughtful about stewarding the financial resources of your organization, I think will stand you in good stead. And we have lots of resources. We could have gone until next summer. but we just didn't see a way out, and we didn't see a way that this business was going to be successful. So we decided to, as I said, return cash to shareholders. That's not the situation most of you are in, but that financial stewardship is important.
Well, you know, as you're talking about that, Meg, one thing that strikes me is that both for you and Mr. Katzenberg, there had to be a sense of humility about what you were doing, because you talk about returning cash to shareholders, and in this very dynamic environment and the flexibility that's required to live in it, being all of us being able to say, you know what, we have a great idea. Maybe it wasn't the right timing. I think we've seen that in sports, yes. Right? We have great ideas, great promotions, great way to sell a new suite or a sponsorship package. But how do you actually communicate those kind of messages to the people who you wanted previously to trust you and to trust your judgment?
Yeah. Well, listen, I think communication today is super important. And what I think I've learned over the last, you know, sort of 2 to 5 years is going directly to your customers, if it's a customer issue, is the best thing that you can do. Go directly to the people that you're trying to reach, whether it's through social media or something like Medium, you know, which is where a lot of people put out what they're trying to get across, you know, one or two very well thought out media placements. But it's a completely different world. And I think fans and other folks expect to be reached out to personally. And then, of course, if you're talking to executives in your organization, you know, executive communication is an art. And most, I'm sure most of you guys know that, you know, executives don't have a lot of time, and they're hopping from thing to thing to thing. And so always start the meeting with, okay, remember where I left you last time. It's great for boards of directors too, by the way, because they come every 3 or 4 months. Remember where we left you last? And many people say, of course they remember where you left us last, but actually often they don't. And so, and then, you know, make your point. I was schooled early on as a young executive, answer first. What's the answer? Then what's the supporting data? And then tell them the answer again.
Interesting. So you talk about the way that we should lead our teams. Crisis management, change management, big topics. That's why communications are so important. When a sports team is going through a situation right now where we don't know, for example, when our fans are going to, in full, be able to come back to the stadium or the arena, I'm not asking you to write our communications plan for us, but what are some key points you think that we ought to be considering and remembering when communicating out about the uncertainty that's still in front of us?
So I would say authenticity, right? If you don't know, say you don't know. You know, fans are very, and consumers now are very good at ferreting out authentic communication versus corporate speak. And I think authentic communication on the part, maybe the players can speak for you, maybe the coaches can speak for you, maybe, you know, individuals who manage that interaction with fans can speak. I think it's super important because, you know, people just need to know that you're telling them what you know. And in this situation, sometimes you don't know, and it's okay to say that. But we're doing our very best to bring you back as soon as we can in a safe way. But authenticity is the one thought I would leave you with in today's environment.
Am I incorrect in assuming that perhaps in recent business memory, there hasn't been a time when authenticity and genuineness, truthfulness, candor has been more important?
I mean, I think that's right. We haven't seen anything like this. I've never seen anything like this in my career. I bet everyone who's at this conference has never seen anything like this. But there's been a trend towards this for sure, Rob, you know, towards that authentic communication, that realness. I think it's really, you know, very, very important. And it's been a trend that's a long time coming, but I think now people really value it.
It's also refreshing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you can actually, I've said this before, so those who know me, forgive the repetition, but when you're honest, you can have a very short memory, right? Because right. You don't have to remember, okay, now how did we put that last time?
Right.
And now there's a difference between honesty and bluntness. And I'm sure you've had to learn that throughout your career, because how you communicate it, like I could tell my spouse, I hate that outfit you just bought. That would be blunt and honest, but probably not appropriate. So, and maybe you have some experience with that. How do you measure, or how do you kind of balance between bluntness so that people go, man, she just tells it like it is, but also tact, and always keeping that bridge of honesty between them.
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing is remember who you're talking to and where are they in their journey of understanding. Mm-hmm. Now, in the example you use, your wife will never understand that. So that probably wouldn't be a good strategy.
Right.
But where are people in their journey of understanding? And I also, if you can, I try to listen as much as I speak, because if you can let people speak and speak their mind, even if the decision doesn't go their way, they feel heard. And I think that's true for fans. I think it's true for executives. You know, people understand, at least if they felt, okay, well, at least I got heard. And, you know, the decision didn't go my way, or the conversation wasn't exactly the way I would have done it. They give you the benefit of the doubt.
I like that. That's good advice. Now, speaking of advice, let's turn a little bit towards your decisions to get involved in sports as aggressively and actively as you are today in Major League Soccer and FC Cincinnati. What was it about that league? What was it about that particular franchise, that market, and certainly about sports as a whole, where you decided to make such a significant investment of your time and resources?
Yeah. So listen, sports is one of the great industries in America. And when I invest behind trends, because what I have learned in my long, long career is better to have wind at your back, because all boats rise in a rising tide, as opposed to gale force winds at one's face. And I've done it both ways. eBay was wind at my back, and HP was gale force winds, because many of our businesses, when I started, were businesses that were on the wrong side of history. Hmm. And so the trends were wrong, declining markets. So when our family office was looking at sports, we said, what are the sports that we think are the sports of the future that are really growing, that have the potential to grow huge audiences from where they are today? And we actually identified two. Soccer would be one, particularly in the United States, because it's not as well established here. And second, we're an investor in esports. And both of those, if you look at the numbers, it's up and to the right. And so we said, okay, so those are the two sports we want to invest in. And then you start saying, okay, what about the ownership group? Because we were not going to be a majority owner of either, although we are the majority owner of the Immortals Gaming Club in LA. But we knew we weren't necessarily going to be the majority owner. So your business partners are super, super important. And if I've learned one thing in my 40 years, it really matters who you're in business with. Honesty, integrity, values, a similar outlook on the world. And so we looked at a lot of different clubs and a lot of different opportunities, and we really just felt, very aligned with Carl Lindner and his ownership group. And we said, you know, these people, they view the world the same way we do. They're super honest and high integrity, and they want to do the right things for players, for fans, for investors, for the city. And we actually got quite comfortable with Cincinnati as a smaller market, because if you look at soccer, some of the smaller markets like Portland, where you used to live, are among the most successful franchises. And sometimes when you're in a smaller market where you don't have four or five or six big sports teams, sometimes that's a good place to launch something like a new soccer club. So that's how we decided.
Well, and you also have tremendous familiarity with Cincinnati. Yes. Because earlier in your professional career, as everyone knows, you worked for Procter & Gamble, account manager at that time, product manager. Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, but...
assistant brand manager.
Brand manager, thank you. So I didn't even know they called them brand managers.
Back in the day, they did. Yeah.
not to suggest anything about back in the day, but...
back in the day.
About Cincinnati, though... Have you always kept ties there? I know professionally you've been on the board of P&G for a number of years. So obviously that market was attractive to you, not only because of the size, but perhaps the culture.
Yeah, I mean, I had kept ties there and I have been on the board, but that was not a determinative factor. I mean, you know, there's lots of other similarly sized cities that we thought could be equally attractive. It was a bonus for us that I happened to, you know, have contacts there and know the city a little bit better than I otherwise would have. But it was a more generalized approach to what's the sport, what's the ownership group, and then does the city make sense?
I would also like to add, if I could, I want to get your comment on this. The leadership, not only at the franchise level, but at the league level of Major League Soccer, has done such an impressive job in growing the sport and, you know, spreading the influence of soccer around North America. Don Garber, Mark Abbott, friends of mine, friends of yours, share some thoughts, because you've been in so many corporate environments. You've been in so many board meetings. Give us some thoughts about the leadership of Major League Soccer.
Yeah, I think they've done a very nice job. I mean, and it's been a long build. You know, people always think when something's successful like it is now, well, it was an overnight success. Isn't it amazing what they've done? But if you look at what Don has been working on with his team, it's a 20-year journey with some pretty significant ups and downs in the beginning. But I have to say, I think they've done a really, really nice job. And I think, you know, in startups, often you say it's something about to hit the knee of the curve. You know what I mean by that? It sort of goes along, and all of a sudden it takes off. I think soccer is just at that inflection point, which is an exciting time to be an owner and be involved in that sport.
Now, whether you're a soccer team, football, and I mean the American football, baseball, basketball, what have you, we're all trying to create content. And now we're trying to stay relevant and be interesting to our fan base and even our would-be fan base. You're a content expert. You've been in technology essentially your entire career. But content also seems to be so whimsical by so many people. In other words, just throw something out there and hope that it goes viral. Yeah. And they think that that's good, you know, that that's how you produce content. Give us some insight into, as an expert in content creation and content delivery, what are some principles or even some practices that sports entities always need to keep in mind?
Well, the first thing that when I think about creating content or marketing programs or anything is the number one thing is market segmentation. Who are you trying to reach? Mm-hmm. And then within that, who are the subsegments that are most important to you? Because if you think about the fan base for any of these sports, they're incredibly diverse. Older, younger, male, female, high income, low income, you know, think about the psychographics. And so really the first question that I always ask, and every tough business problem I've ever had often yields to segmentation. And so how do you segment that market and who are you going after? Because usually being all things to all people doesn't really work, or sinking to the lowest common denominator doesn't usually work. So that's the first thing I'd say. And then given you want to go after one or two or three segments, what is it about that segment that they're looking for? You know, are they looking for, behind the scenes, player stories, the history of a team or the history of a sport? What are they looking for that they don't get today? And what they mostly get today is the game and excellent commentary about that game, but they don't necessarily get the backstory. And if you think too, you know, there's always been the backstory that's sort of really interesting. And, you know, maybe a modern version of Hard Knocks, you know, that kind of thing. So I just think you have to really think through, and then what are the trends out there in the marketplace? And the trends out there are definitely back to authenticity, user-generated content. You know, we're so used to, I think in my generation, having everything be flawless. I would say in today, perfect is the enemy of really good. And sometimes if it's too perfect, it doesn't appear to sort of capture the imagination, particularly of the younger audience. And then I do think content is to some degree a hit or miss program. You know, it's very different. You know what it's like? You'll relate to this. It's like politics. Content is nonlinear. You know, sometimes things that people think are not going to make it at all and are, you know, a total miss end up being a huge hit and vice versa. So part of this is experimentation and, you know, try things. And if it works, do more of it. Doesn't work, then don't do that and pivot to something else. So I think those of you who are thinking about content, that experimentation is super important. And then when you find something that works, do more of it.
So how much of that though is based on analytics, the science of it, versus just intuition and just maybe some dumb luck once in a while?
Yeah, it's, and I have learned this now spending the last 2 years in Hollywood. This is a blend, and was the basis of Quibi, which is the joining forces of Silicon Valley, which is a very left brain, analytical, engineering oriented view, with Hollywood, which is completely right brain and intuition. And if you can bring them together, that's sometimes the magic. But I will tell you, creatives are very different than engineers. And so sometimes you just have to let the creatives tell you what their vision is. and let them do it. Not at any cost, but you have to let them. They do things that are quite magical that, and I would count myself among them, the left brain often doesn't see. So it's a blend, but you don't want to do stuff that makes no sense, that has no basis in, you know, in data or facts or analytics. But there's a nice merger there that if appropriately managed, I think you end up with some really great offerings.
Boy, finding that sweet spot, right? Just that perfect middle of the road, yeah. That balance.
And I'll say experiment. Yeah.
So one of the challenges we have though in the sports industry is that we want to be out there, we want to be present, and we want to create platforms by which our fans can engage with us and we with them. But you mentioned politics. Let me talk about something that's somewhat political, not asking for your personal opinion on this, but rather your advice on how we might handle it. There's been a lot of talk recently about platforms, companies, Twitter, Facebook, et cetera, Google, getting called on the carpet in Washington, D.C. because of content, not only creation, but perhaps control. And so where I'm going with this, Meg, is, let's say I run a Major League Soccer team. I want my fans to engage with our website or with our social platforms, but perhaps some of that content that they're producing, the commentary, gets a little bit, it's a little far afield from where we want to be and where we want to be, what we want to be known as. So how do we keep that control while also keeping it authentic and real and not too perfect, like you were suggesting?
Yeah. So my personal view, and this is a very personal view, is that every organization, every team, every group that you're associated with has to have a moral compass. And what the question I always ask my teams is, what is the right thing to do? And this is a complicated question because you and I might have a slightly different point of view about what the right thing to do is, but it is incumbent upon the leadership of that organization to make the moral calls. Mm-hmm. And my view is, everyone needs to make a call about, are they doing the right thing, not just for that moment, for that click, for that, you know, headline. Are they doing the right thing for their team, the players, the country, you know? And it's super important. And I'll tell you a little story that will bring this home. When I was at eBay, our point of view was that if it was legal for sale in the United States or whatever country in the world we were doing business, then it would be legal for sale on eBay. Until we got to household name status. And you'll be interested to know this, that it's legal to sell Nazi memorabilia in the United States. It's not legal in France, it's not legal in Germany, but it is legal here. Hmm. And ultimately we decided that that was not a category of merchandise that we wanted to be involved in. Hmm. We also decided not to sell over the internet, firearms, alcohol, tobacco, because you don't quite know who's buying those products when you're on the internet. So we decided not to sell those. So these were sort of moral issues that ultimately came down to me and our founder, Pierre Omidyar. And other people might've come down under different places. When we got out of those two categories, two new websites popped up and did great business in those categories. But we didn't feel badly about it because we said, you know, we need to, there's something that I call the character of the company, the character of the organization. And people say, well, how do you make those decisions? Because particularly if you're doing business overseas, you know, the Koreans might have a different point of view than the French, than the Germans, whatever. And I say, so usually this works. If your mother, someone you really care about, your mom or your dad or your sister, someone you love and respect was in the room watching you make that decision, would you make the same decision? And if that doesn't work, if it was on the front page of the New York Times or your local newspaper, would you make the same decision? And so that's the kind of thing that I think is super important for organizations.
Great rule of thumb to follow. And I think you're answering kind of my follow-up question. So you've been working with national brands, international brands, your entire career. If I'm a minor league baseball team in a mid-market, I'm not really looking for national, I shouldn't say attention, but I'm not really trying to appeal to a national audience. I'm trying to appeal to my local market, that the culture of that community. So does that weigh into the decision as to whether or not we should allow certain things versus others?
You know, I think it depends what it is. And again, I think it comes back to the owner or the president or the CEO or the coach or whoever is, you know, in charge with that decision. how do they feel about it? Does it reflect well on them? Does it reflect well on the brand they're trying to create? And again, people will come out in different places, and that's okay. As long as people have said, how do I really, really feel about this? As opposed to, it might be good for my business, but I don't feel great about it.
I see. So from your experience and where you see the world today, what are some trends? Because you talked about trends. You like to follow the trends. You like to have the wind at your back. What are some trends that perhaps the sports industry, and I know you've been very busy with Quibi and other things, you know, as I said, being on the board of P&G, but from the sports industry, for the sports industry, what are some trends that perhaps you think we're missing, especially as it relates to technology, or what are some trends that we need to be keeping an eye on right now?
Well, I think actually the sports teams are doing pretty well on this dimension in many ways. You know, FC Cincinnati, we're building a new stadium. And what's always great is when you have, you know, a de novo site. Okay, so we have a de novo stadium, brand new stadium. So we can take every bit of technology and put it into that stadium. But you have to think, for example, holistically about the fan experience, and your connectivity in that stadium is absolutely critical. Because think about what you want to be able to, those fans to be able to do. You want them to be able to navigate to their seat off their smartphone. You want them to be able to find the restroom with the shortest line. You want them to be able to order, obviously, food from their seat. You want them to be able to go, if they want to go to the concession stand, where's the shortest line? You want them to be able to replay something they saw that on the field that was totally cool. And think about it, if you've got a big stadium, a soccer stadium of 20 or 30 or 40,000 folks, and or an NFL stadium with many more than that, think about the replay and the bandwidth requirements on that stadium. And that fan experience, I think, with technology can be completely differentiated. And so that's super important. Also, collecting the data about what your fans are doing, not by name, not by Rob or Meg, but collectively, what are they doing? And what can you learn from that? You know, how do you, back to what do they like that you're doing, and how can you give them more of it versus things that they're not really taking advantage of? And all of that, that I would call that big data and analytics, super important. And I think every company now should think of themselves as a technology company. If you don't have a data scientist or a data engineer or a, you know, an analytics team, and you don't have a pretty darn good chief information officer, I think you're probably falling behind. You may not know it yet, but I think you're falling behind. By the way, it's less expensive now. Given cloud computing, you know, when we set up eBay, I don't know how much money we spent, you know, building, you know, our own data center and buying all the servers and kitting it out. You know, today, you know, when we launched eBay, we basically built this app completely in the cloud. And so the capital cost was dramatically less. And so technology isn't nearly as expensive as it used to be, which means the barriers to entry are less, but it also means smaller teams can compete with bigger teams can, you know, do things. And so I think it's a real addition and a real enabler of fundamentally evolving the fan experience.
This this evolution that you're describing, we're seeing it in real time right now. As you and I are talking, the World Series is a game or two away from completing, the NBA Finals, the Stanley Cup just wrapped up. And we're seeing sports in a way that none of us would have imagined 10 months ago. What's your view of it as a fan? How do you view sports right now? And do you like it? Or does it, you know, are you tired of watching it on TV? Do you want to get out there?
Well, what I will tell you is when sports was completely shut down, like our household went into withdrawal. I mean, we really missed watching sports on TV. We missed going, but we probably, like everyone else, watches more on TV. We missed it dramatically. I mean, you know, we'd sort of look at each other on a Saturday or Sunday and go, well, you know, where's our sports? So I think we really missed that. Now that it's back on television, now we miss going to the venue. I mean, we happen to like doing that. It's, we meet friends, we see people. It's part of being something greater than, you know, yourself. It's being, you know, part of a team effort, even though you're just a fan, you're not actually helping, but you're cheering them on. And, you know, particularly soccer, I mean, the fans are just wild. And in a good way. And so we miss not being able to go in person, but I will tell you, our household is very happy that sports is back on TV.
Well, do you think that this let's say, temporary normal we're in right now. Do you think this is, you mentioned that the coronavirus, the pandemic, it's going to be here for a while. That's your viewpoint. Do you think this way of observing sports is going to be with us for the next several months or years?
I do. I think it may be well into next year. I think, honestly, you've seen it. You know, you just see these waves of spikes in the virus. And I think this is not going to return to any sense of normal until we have a vaccine. And, you know, I'm not a scientist. My husband is. And I think that's going to be, you know, mid next year would be my guess. I think the other thing to think about is it's important for your audience is think about how many different ways there are now to consume sports. You know, it's not just TV, it's mobile, it's streaming services. And so I think the ability to give your fans what they want to see, when they want to see it, how they want to pay for it, that flexibility is going to be super important. And I think, you know, over time, these big media contracts, they start to dissipate in importance over time. Because if you look at the television viewing audience, it's going straight down. I mean, if you're under the age of 30, you should, I mean, I'm sure your audience knows this. I mean, the television viewing of the younger audience is strikingly low. And, you know, so that's something that as you think about capturing the next generation, that we're all going to have to be pretty focused on.
We have to be creative, innovative. That's why conferences like ALSD are so important to our industry's future. So can I just clarify, though, something you were talking about? Do you see the model that we're going to be that we're going to have to pursue being more subscription based or PPV pay per view? Do you see it more still on the ad generated side?
Yeah. All of the above. Mm. All of the above. It's not going to be pick one and go with it. Mm. It's going to be, okay, what's your ad supported venue? What's your subscription offering? What's your, you know, streaming offering that could be the same as a subscription offering? I think we're going to have to think very carefully. Back to market segmentation, what are the offerings that we're going to have to make available to our fans?
You know, the way that you're talking about sports, I have to ask you, based on where you're at today and where you spend your time moving forward, are we going to see you more involved in FC Cincinnati or in other sports enterprises or projects?
Well, I spend, you know, when asked, Carl Lindner is the majority owner of FC Cincinnati. And so when he asks, I certainly try to help in any way I can. And then if I've got ideas, but I also believe that someone has to be in charge. You know, too many cooks in the kitchen, and you end up not being as sort of smart, I think, as you can be. So I will be as involved as Carl would like me to be in FC Cincinnati. And then I'm actually spending a fair amount of time, you know, on esports, our LA franchise and our, you know, gaming platform in Brazil. And I don't happen to be a gamer, but I can see the trends. So I'll spend more time on those two things for sure. You know, we'll see what happens next. But I enjoy it. It's great fun. And, you know, it's quite different than anything I've ever done before. You know, Major League Sports is different than, you know, working for a Procter & Gamble, for a Bain & Company, for an eBay, for a Disney. It's I think, a bit more entrepreneurial and a little bit less linear. Hmm.
You've talked several times about following the trends. Let me ask you, on behalf of those people who are watching or listening right now, who they see a trend, not so much with their business or their industry, but with their career. Mm-hmm. And that trend is something that they don't like. They're saying, you know what, I've got to switch things up. This is not going the direction that I had hoped. So I'm asking this, Meg, because you've worked at Procter & Gamble and Disney and eBay and Hewlett Packard and now, of course, Quibi and your work now in MLS, you've obviously seen times in your career when it was time to move. It was time to make an adjustment or a pivot. Can you give those of us who perhaps are considering a pivot in our own careers some advice? What are the things we should be looking for, or what are the things that we should be avoiding when making those kinds of career decisions?
Yeah. Well, let me reframe it for you, because please. I don't think it's so much about leaving something, it's going to something. Usually you make a mistake if you're trying to get away from something. when it works is when you see something very clearly that is interesting and has a big opportunity for you. And so I think it's more about what is coming your way, what's happening in the world that you think is interesting, that you have a passion for. Passion is an important thing. And it's what I admire about most people in sports. They actually care about their job. They care about the league, or they care about the players, or they care about the sport. And it is a team sport. So I would say, you know, as opportunities come your way, I always look at a couple of things. You know, what are the friends like? You know, will wind be at your back? Who are the people you're going to be doing it with? They spend a lot of time at work. And I really think it's important for you to respect and like and trust the people that you're going to do business with. Trust is paramount for me. Because even when you're in a foxhole, as we were with Quibi, Jeffrey and I trusted each other. And, you know, there was never any backbiting and, you know, snarkiness. And that's super important because you don't know what way things are going to go. And then lastly, I would say, you know, is it a stretch for you? Is it something where you're going to learn something? You know, I learned a ton from Quibi, and, you know, I'm, you know, not at the beginning of my career anymore. So what are you going to learn? You know, and then the thing I always ask, particularly if you're going to go to something that's a little bit more risky, and people have to evaluate their risk profile. People have very different risk profiles. I happen to have a high risk profile. But, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen?
Yeah.
And you have to say, you know, like when I went to eBay, I said, what's the worst thing that can happen? I'll go get another job. You know, when I went to HP, and a lot of people said I should not go to HP. I said, what's the worst thing that can happen? You know, I'll figure it out. And but you have to be prepared for the worst thing that can happen. And I would not be paralyzed by fear. I would, you know, lean into the possibilities and to have courage. And, you know, that old phrase, nothing ventured, nothing gained.
Good advice. Wise advice. I'd like to wrap up, if we could, Meg, by giving you several quick questions. And maybe you could give us just kind of what comes to mind first.
Sure.
I was going to call these quick bites.
But that's okay. You can still call them quick bites. I think, you know, what we did is we did actually create a new category of mobile viewing. So it's
that's
fine.
Right. It continues to live on and be a part of our culture. So here's the first quick bite for you. If you are a sales or a team leader, what's a book you should be reading?
Yeah. Experimentation Works by a guy named Tom Key. T-H-O-M-K-E, Experimentation Works. It's relatively new, and it's a really good read.
Awesome. Now, if you're a new executive in the sports and entertainment industry, maybe not long after college, you've joined our industry, what's a book we ought to be reading?
So this, I no matter what industry you're in, if you're a new to business, you've got to read Good to Great. It's sort of the business. I think, you know, everyone has to read Good to Great. I probably read it 4 or 5 times, and I'm sure you've read it. It's just one of those great, great Hallmark touchstone books.
Yeah. Should be in everybody's library.
Yeah.
Who's your favorite athlete?
Gosh, that's a hard one, because I tend to, you know, be very admiring of female athletes, but I have to say probably right now, LeBron James. And I'll tell you why. Please. He's been incredible. Like, just raw athletic talent, how he's conducted himself has been remarkable. And I'm particularly admiring of the work that he's been doing with his school, and now schools, out of Akron, Ohio, called I Promise. And education happens to be a passion of mine. And so what he did is he said, for these very challenged kids who have all kinds of family issues and poverty and all kinds of things, he figured he had to do almost like a surround sound. And so he helped the parents. He gave folks a place to live. He, you know, had very small classes and really focused in on these kids. And the results are extraordinary. And he's done a remarkable job in Akron. And he's now starting to roll them out. So I admire his athletic prowess. I admire him as a human being. And I admire what he's done on education.
You talk about education being very important to you. I remember that about you when you ran for governor of California in 2010. Here's the next quibby, the next quick bite. What lessons did you learn running for such a public office that we all should be applying?
Yeah. So thick skin.
Alligator skin.
when you are in public office and when you're in business, but particularly running for public office or in public office, it's almost guaranteed that only half the people are going to like what you're doing at any given point in time, meaning half the people are not. And the barbs and the arrows and the things that come at you is remarkable. And I ran in 2010, and think about what's happened in the last decade. It's even worse now. So that's the first thing. You've got to have a thick skin, no matter what you do. And once you've decided you're doing the right thing, you just have to sort of block it out and say, okay, this is what I'm going to do until I've been proven that I've made a mistake or something. So I think that's the first thing. The second thing I learned is communication. So having spent a career in business, I was pretty good at talking to analysts and shareholders and board members and my teams. What I learned in politics was to talk to very large groups of people. And think about how you do that. It's very different. The facts, the figures, the left brain is not nearly as powerful as the right brain. It's the stories that you tell. And look at when the president does State of the Union addresses, both parties tell stories. Why do they have the people up in the balcony? Because they're telling stories about those folks, and people remember the stories. I promise you, they do not remember the analysis. They don't remember the facts and figures. They do remember the stories. And so I'm a better CEO because of that. When I went to HP, it turned out HP was about exactly the same size as the state of California. Same budget, same number of people. And so I said, we've got to change HP. We've got to pull HP into the 21st century. And I borrowed a lot of things I'd learned in politics from a communications perspective to lead at HP. Hmm. The last thing is, we should be glad that anyone wants to run for public office. And I know you ran for public office, you know, and we both lost, but that's not the point. The point is, how can you give back? And whether it's city council or school board or, you know, state senate or state assembly, you know, people should actually think about getting involved. Because if people like at this conference don't get involved, I think we're missing out on some real talent that is going to be needed over the next decade of this country.
Couldn't agree more. I have a follow-up question to that. But before the follow-up question, would you agree, since you mentioned that we do have that one thing in common where we both ran, we happened to run the same year. I was in Oregon, you were in California. Would you agree this lesson that I learned, which was your friends may disappoint you, but strangers will amaze you?
Yeah.
Did you learn that?
Absolutely. I mean, you probably found this. You were, I think, running for Congress, so you weren't traveling the whole state. I was running for governor, so I got to see California in a way I'd never seen California. I went to all but two counties. I saw the Central Valley, you know, obviously San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego, on the border. I mean, it was incredible. And I think everyone who runs for office comes away thinking their state or their country is really quite extraordinary and the people are quite extraordinary. And what you learn from being out and about is an incredible life lesson. I'm really glad I did it. You know, it changed my life, and it changed how I think about politics, how I think about our state. And it was a wrenching experience in many ways, but it was also a really good experience.
You took the words out of my mouth. You said it better than I could. And you said it better than I've tried to say it in the past. So I would be remiss if I didn't ask on behalf of our audience, if the right opportunity came about, could you see yourself throwing your hat back into the public ring?
I don't think I will run again for public office. I actually think that running for office for me was one of the other lessons learned. It was a bad job person fit. And what I mean by that is, to run for public office, you need to be a combatant. You need to love combat. And you know this, you know, when you're doing a media interview, you say up, they say down. If you say down, they say up. I mean, it's a given, it's a combat sport. And today it is a full-on combat sport. And I'm actually not wired for combat. I love to compete, but that constant 8 hours a day of, it's why litigators are excellent politicians. They love that and they're really good at it. So I think I found it to be incredibly difficult, incredibly wearing. And so I would not run again, that's for sure.
I understand what you're saying. And I appreciate your self-awareness, because I think anyone running for office needs to have that before they throw themselves into it.
Yeah. And so, I thought I was pretty competitive. I mean, you know, I was raised playing sports and I, you know, I love to win and I love to compete. It's a whole nother realm. It's, you know, it's just a whole, it's a completely different thing than competing in business or competing in sports.
We'll have to talk some other time more about this topic, but I have one more question for you that I think everyone would be interested to hear your answer. If you could sit in someone else's desk for one day, who would that person be?
It's a good question. So I'll give you one. I think maybe you'll find surprising. Angela Merkel.
Oh.
So, you know, the head of Germany, prime minister of Germany, chancellor of Germany. She is a remarkable woman, just remarkable. Think how long she has been in office. Think about her role in pulling together the European Union, which is fraying, you know, embracing some things that were very unpopular in her country, like immigration. And how she has forged relationships with those other European leaders. I just think it'd be fascinating. And the crazy thing is, as you probably know, she was born in East Germany.
Yeah.
And, you know, has sort of risen to power in, you know, a unified Germany and has been one of the, you know, probably most influential, most successful leaders of that country. So I'd sit behind her desk for a day, see what she knew.
That is a fascinating answer. And it did surprise me, but I can see you'd be a great fit there. Well, Meg, this has been really rewarding for all of us. Sure appreciate you taking the time. We're so grateful in the sports and entertainment industry that we've got you, that we've got the benefit of your intellect and your experience and your vision. And we certainly look forward to having your participation even to a larger extent if you'll let us. But thank you for joining us at ALSD and at GameFace. We really appreciate this.
You're entirely welcome. Thanks very much for having me.
Thanks for being a part of this episode of Game Face Execs. If you found any of it useful or helpful, please rate or like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. I always appreciate you referring us to others as well. I'll see you next week. Until then, persuade, influence, inspire.